outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
I am so grateful to finally have Finding Church out there and being able to engage conversations about it with so many of you who are reading it, and at least by the feedback I'm getting, some of you are actually enjoying it, which is always a fun surprise. Hi, I'm Wayne Jacobson. I want to welcome you to this edition of The God Journey, and no, it's not going to be about Finding Church. It's actually going to be about death in a minute, but before we get there, there's a couple things I want to highlight. I had a conversation yesterday with a man who I gave a copy of the book to a couple weeks before. Didn't know that he would enjoy this book particularly. He attends a fellowship in the area and pretty committed to it. Saw him again yesterday and he said, "That book you gave me." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh my gosh, it was not what I expected." I said, "What did you expect?" He said, "I thought it'd be the 12 things to look for when you try and pick out a good church." He said, "You take church to a completely different level, to understand what's behind it, the church Jesus is building." And he got excited. I thought it might threaten him. He actually got thrilled. And he said, "This explains." He said, you talk in the first chapter about these men creations that become oftentimes very authoritative and very controlling. He said, "Now I understand why 2/3 of the people have left our congregation in the last few months, because that's where we're going, and it's hurtful and destructive to people." And it was just his eyes were open, and he said, "This is talking about a church I love. I can't wait to read more of it." It's fun to be in those conversations. I'm getting lots of email from some of you, and just if I could encourage you, and I'm loving the emails, and you're welcome to respond to me as much as you want. I'm hoping somehow to generate a conversation beyond just me and individuals. I'm hoping some of you that are getting stuff out of it or have insights to add to it would kind of start sharing that in a couple of venues. One, findingchurch.com is a website that we're creating to help spawn a bigger conversation that I hope eventually, once the book's been out long enough and people are done being excited about reading it and are actually learning to live the life or have already illuminated the fact that they are, would share some of those insights, comments, questions at findingchurch.com or the Facebook page for Finding Church. So if you're kind of got some stuff that you're excited about, or even questions that you are concerned about, or even concerns, those are some venues that we hope to get a conversation going that's bigger than me and bigger than this podcast, and, you know, just invites people into a larger conversation. So if you don't mind having a look at that, it might be helpful to you. That's findingchurch.com. Or the Facebook page, Finding Church, and I'll put links at the bottom of this. Also, before we get into the podcast of the day, I want to talk to you a bit about Kenya. We have decided that it probably is in our purview to help stock this first 22 months of the dispensary. After that, the government will take over the medications and needs for that facility. But in the initial stages, they just don't have it to put into that area. I'm hoping they will on the backside. Normally, it's 36 months. They've shortened that to 22 since we helped build the dispensary to begin with. And actually, the Ministry of Health guy for the country of Kenya in that area is incredibly excited and blessed at the generosity that many of you have shown in helping us build that there, build the wells, and kind of the relief that's going on. They've been shocked that people from America would care enough to get involved. So we have. We put almost $360,000 there this year through your generosity, and I know that's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous amount of money. If you haven't been involved in that with us, please, there's just no guilt for that. God's been providing, and we're grateful for those that have felt connected to it and wanted to. And if that's not been in your purview or your ability to do so, or you're involved in other things, that's awesome too. But we are needing an extra $32,500 to stock this dispensary for the first 22 months. And just going to put that out there again. If you have some ability to help us and desire to do so, you can send that to Lifestream. We'll also provide links at the website. And again, every dime we get, we don't take money out even for the money transfer fees that we have to get the money to Kenya. Every dime you send will get into that country and help people now who are gathering at the dispensary, even though there's nothing there to help people with. The sick have no place else to go. So now there's a bunch of them camped out around it. They're dying there. And we're going to look to see if we can help get that stocked for them. So if you want to help us do so. Got this email from Arla. I'm not going to do a lot of email on this podcast, but I do want to share this one. Just Arla, and this is about the Angel Feathers redo. We kind of got back into some of that revival stuff with Brad. She says, it was one of the best God Journey podcasts I have ever heard. But one point of interest, if those of us who have had any connection with any of the healing ministries would be honest, we would all agree we've at least wondered why God heals here and not there, heals this one and not that one. I love the answer you two had for that question. Everything in me lit up with agreement that is truly is about the relationship and not about anything we do, methods, or have, faith, or claim and rebuke. And Arla, thanks for that. I love that too. I think it's that honesty that's so important. The contrast between an angel feather found over here and a person dying of cancer who may have flown 7,000 miles to get to a service in hope of being healing. And somebody's excited about an angel feather and somebody's dying of cancer. And we've just got to be honest about that. I don't know what conclusion you want to come to about it, but the honesty of it is so helpful. Otherwise, it just reduces God to the trivial. Yeah, I throw angel feathers and gold dust. But no, the bigger needs right here are going unmet. And that has to make us wonder. And I don't really much gotten to the talk of, well, you got to start small and work your way up. If it's God's the ones doing it and it's real, then I think it's going to touch the deepest needs, not the casual. And not that God's not interested in those too, but to deal with the frivolous at the expense of the deep is not good enough. And then we get to the reality. And I tell you, I don't want to beat that revival drum to death anymore, but I want to talk a bit about death. The most emails I've gotten from any podcast this year have been about my mom's passing and our family dealing with that journey. And people who just said, man, I'm so glad you shared it because we are going through it, have been through it, whatever. Not enough people talk about death and dying. And I know it's not a great topic to touch on, but it amazes me that probably that's why we don't talk about it enough and why people who finally hear it talked about go, man, that's helpful. Thank you very much. But it is by far of all the topics I've talked about on this podcast over the last year, people's comments about the ones dealing with death and dying and what we were going through with my mom, who, if you don't know, passed away this past July. And our experience with that was very different than most people. As other people relate to me, their experience of losing their mom or dad and how gut-wrenching that was and how unmoored their life seemed for a while because of that, and even grief that they didn't anticipate. And I don't think any of us know what grief we face when we lose people close to us in our lives. So I don't know that 4 or 5 months out now that we've experienced it all. But our whole journey with my mom through that and my dad had been filled with such grace and God engagement. And I mean, God putting things on my dad's heart that he'd share in tears, God inviting him into this deeper place of dependency that we talked about. I have so enjoyed what God did around all that. And I haven't talked a lot about this as we came to the end of that. My daughter and I went up and spent some time with my mom one day up and back. It's a 5-hour drive, 5 hours up, 5 hours back, 5 hours there. And at the twilight, this was now about 10 days before my mom actually passed away. And one of the last few days when she was lucid and clear, and the sweetest things my mom has ever said to me or my family, she said on that day. There was a place of tenderness, even in the desperateness of her situation, a grateful heart that emerged. And I kind of want that to set the context for some of what I want to talk about today. Last night, Sarah and I had dinner with a couple that we have known for years, whose 12-year-old daughter passed away, probably not more than a couple of months ago. She was perfectly healthy and then began to have some symptoms in the hospital. They found out she had aplastic anemia of the most severe kind. And within 5 months, she had passed away before they could do bone marrow transplants or anything. And we had a chance to be with this couple last night and hear their story and hear all that God had done in gracing them through what has got to be the most incredibly painful bit of their lives. And yet they talk about it. And they said, I don't even know that we know what grief is here yet. We've seen God's hand in so many incredible ways. We've also hurt. We've hurt deeply to realize that our only child wasn't going to make it. And it's the only, because the wife is an only child in her family, it's the last in that line. And just to hear them talk about God's grace being in that moment and how God touched them and touched her and what they learned about trust from a young, I remember sitting on her bed one night and he turned to her in the hospital and he said, "Are you scared, honey? This is toward the end." And she said, "I'm not, Dad." And he said, "Why not?" She says, "'Cause I trust," with a smile on her face. And he said, it reduced him to tears because he didn't trust near the way she was trusting. Although this has shaped some wonderful stuff in them. We had a great conversation with them last evening. And then a few weeks ago, I relayed this when I was in Lexington, had a chance after a marriage seminar, actually, or marriage sharing, whatever, to talk with a young woman who just recently married, whose 13-year-old daughter, whom this woman helped raise as the older sister in the family, had passed away unexpectedly with a tragic, tragic accident, and dealing with the throes of death. And her thought was, why wasn't it me? Why her and not me? Her whole life's ahead of her. And this gal couldn't have been more than young 20s, really young 20s. And yet her thought was, this person is so much more gifted than I am. And I looked there and I said, do you really think God like made a decision waking up one morning? I need one of the Proctor girls. I made up the name. To come home today, and I think I'll check the youngest, most innocent. No. Even the language, God took her, is, I think, such a fallacy about death. Death is God's last great enemy. That's his language in Paul's words in Corinthians. It's the last great enemy to be destroyed. And when we get affected by death, and death is not new to me. One of my best friends in high school passed away at 17, brain tumor. We'd prayed for healing, believed God for healing, and watched him fade away and die. I've prayed for others who've been healed. So that didn't jade me to the supernatural, but it kind of brought me into the space of if God was going to heal off the intensity or whatever, innocence of young high school kids praying for their buddy, hoping God would bring healing to a family deeply committed to Christ, and that not happen. And then it's death is part of life. Some people miss it for a lot. I don't know if it's because I was pastoring or just know a lot of people, but I've been engaged with close friends dying. I've been engaged with young people dying, that way too young to die. I've been in those rooms with prophecies about the sickness is not unto death, and they die. And I hope we get to have the honest conversation about death. And what the theme to me, as I think hopefully come through as we get to some of the things I'm going to share down the road in this podcast, is that there's a lot of hope in the midst of death. Death is not God's friend, although death secures eternity for that which is holy and that which is unstained and undefiled by our brokenness and our sin. So God has a place to save us too. So death serves his purpose in this, in that it brings an end to this age and allows us to access what we were always created to be a part of, and that's the age to come, however that might look. But it's still out of the tragedy of death and the separation of people we love that God works some amazing stuff. God's grace is in it. God's grace is around it. God's presence as we walk through it. It's amazing what I think I'm beginning to understand even about the process of dying. Now, that brings us to an email I got recently. Asked me if I would actually talk about euthanasia on a podcast. And he wrote me this email, and some of it's just really good in terms of his own spiritual journey. And then he gets to the question a little bit later on. As a Christian of nearly 40 years, I have grown up and been taught within the institutional church for most of my Christian life, held to their teachings. However, in recent years, something has stirred within me. Something inside me has been saying there must be more to God, to Jesus, and the church than what has been taught and proclaimed from the pulpit at this time. This has led me to search for something deeper, something real, and something more than I have now. I have gradually grown weary of the religious, pious, empty nonsense and falsehood that is rife within the modern church. Through long study and much soul-searching, I am now getting to know the real heart of my Father. My misconceptions of his character are being stripped away to reveal his love, heart of love for me. I've gone from just seeing Jesus as purely a sacrifice to cover my sin and ugliness in order for God to accept me, to knowing the sacrifice of Jesus has opened the way for my Father and I to have a loving relationship that He has always intended as before the fall of Adam. Amen, Greg. I like that stuff. I do, and I like people that are willing. And I got an email the other day. The reason I read that first part, got an email the other day from someone who said, you know, a blog comment or Facebook, my mom and dad are challenging things I'm thinking because do you think you're better than all the people that have come before us and taught us this thing and or taught us what Christianity is and religion is? And I know that's a common it's a common way for people to challenge folks. Who do you think you are? We have all these theologians who've written all this stuff and all this people have been to seminary and they teach this stuff in the Bible. And now you're saying it might be wrong. You're saying you're not going to believe anymore. Who do you think you are? And it challenges our sense of humility in the sense that, oh, now we have to be prideful to believe what we believe. I love the fact that people go back and say, maybe what I taught was wrong. Maybe what I was taught was wrong. Maybe it was. And I don't think it violates all the historic theologians. In fact, I think most of what we have throughout church history of people who've had a vibrant relationship with Jesus are in sync with the things that we're talking about today. These are not new theologically. They're new in terms of the institution's need to control people by fear and guilt. So it's always seems new in that context. But the best voices in history among the brothers and sisters of the family have talked about a God who loves, who invites us into a real relationship where the life of the church is based on the community of friends and family, not on people being in their institutional knothole. And so it looks like it's very humble to say, you know, who are you to whatever, but it actually is something that distracts people because now it makes them feel prideful instead of, you know what, couldn't we all take a look at things we've been taught and step back and say, what in this was true about God? And what in this is not true about God? And wouldn't, even generationally speaking, don't you think Jesus would be growing His church up so that we would be seeing with greater clarity things that people saw as shadows in generations past? I hope so. I hope the things I've written and done in my lifetime are not the end of it, that people, you know, 30 years from now, oh, Wayne said this, Wayne said that. I hope it goes on. I mean, I read things in T. Austin Sparks and, Andrew Murray and they get the clarity of some of these pictures. But I do think in our generation, the conversation that's gone on has moved that forward. And I hope the next generation moves it forward yet again. Why wouldn't we want to be growing in the grace and wisdom of God as this church takes on, without spot or wrinkle, takes on a greater understanding and demonstration of who He is in the world? So Greg's been through that, kind of processed that, realizing, hey, there is, you know, study, prayer, conversation opens us to truths that other folks may have missed. Doesn't make us arrogant to embrace something that's true. Arrogance is how we try to push it on others. That may get to where our arrogance is, but certainly not in the discovery of something new. And then he gets into the issue he wanted me to talk about. He says, understand life is God-given and precious, and we need to protect it. However, if someone has an illness or injury, that means their quality of life is sitting in a wheelchair, unable to communicate or move, and all their dignity stripped. Wouldn't they have a choice to end it once they get to the point where they've had enough? The church seems to be intent on pushing this belief on society, which in turn only serves to show the church is controlling, insensitive, and condemning of other people's views and opinions. This is a surefire way of making the church seem out of date and irrelevant. The world sees the church as the mouthpiece and personality of God, although I think that's less so. And he says, this is indisputable, but I do think it's less so. I do think people are kind of saying, you know, regardless of what that says, maybe that's not God behind it. So what is the choice we are proclaiming here? That God is so hard-hearted, so cold, and so inflexible, though no matter what someone is going through, that they are not allowed to have the choice to end their own life, even when there is no cure and they are in constant pain. Is our God of love really saying, I don't care how much you're suffering, if we just engage our brains for a moment and look at the issue in its simplest form, what is the point of someone being kept artificially alive if they had the choice to end it? Don't we do this with animals? What about people in comas who are kept alive by machines? And He says, could you talk about this someday? And he's actually published an article on his blog, I don't remember where that was, that actually advances the notion that euthanasia is okay with God and part of his compassionate thing. And I'll be honest with you, Greg, I'm not there yet. If I'm going to get there, it's going to take some time, especially in light of the last few weeks or months of my life. Because there's a tendency to look at death and the shrinking world that a dying person lives in, the shrinking abilities to comprehend, and to say that that's worthless or undignified, I don't go there. I know those places can be incredibly dark. I know that it challenges us, but look at Stephen Hawking, look at people who are incredibly debilitated, who find a way to communicate and treasure what life they have. So I wouldn't necessarily go, is it a godly thing for us to choose to end it? And I actually faced this, the first dog Sarah and I had to put down, young kids, and we had this dog 14 years, and she was finally at the point of suffering so much, and we called our vet out. It happened to be a friend of ours and a brother in Christ. And we're sitting there and we're talking about my dog, and I'm holding her, loving her still, thinking these are the last minutes of her life. And I said, you know what I'm really wrestling with? Because I've read the whole How Shall We Then Live? And euthanasia is one of the last bastions of society that goes to its godless whatever, and we've got to make stands for those kind of things. And I said, here's the deal. Why is it okay to do for my dog what I don't believe is okay for us to do as people? And his answer was brilliant. I don't know if it's right. I thought it was brilliant. He looked at me and said, you know what? God's given us dominion over the animals. So it's okay for us to decide when it's a compassionate time for their life to end. But God hasn't given us that dominion over our own lives. And he said, maybe God knows best as to what happens. And having watched some people die in my life, I have noticed this, that in the shrinking space of life, hearts get prepared for what I believe is the age to come. In the midst of losing control, can anger and embarrassment and shame come? Yeah, it can. But what I've seen is grace and tenderness and graciousness. And I wonder if even in the horror of death, what God calls his enemy, that he doesn't use even that to prepare our hearts for the world that's to come. And we've got a dear friend that just had her sister pass away after 40 years in a coma, never gained consciousness. It was a car accident, I think 40 years ago. And she finally passed away, kept alive artificially, sure. I don't know about all that. I think that's a lot of how much do you do to keep alive what cannot be sustained on its own? That's a different deal to me than do we actually take life. But there's another question here. So I don't come out in the same place Greg does with this, because I think God is in the dying with us, and I think there's redemptive things that happen. But there's two really issues here. The other issue is, if I come to that thought theologically, do I have a right to enforce that conviction on somebody who doesn't know the God I know? And what we've been told is, we got to make that fight. We got to fight for euthanasia, fight against euthanasia. We've got to keep the world from doing. And so much of how our Christian political stance has gone in recent years is we've got to keep the world from doing what the world does in the name of the God we love, or that we're responsible for, and our responsibility for other people's behaviors is everywhere. And that's where I go with him, that now that shows us as controlling. Jesus said when he came to live among us, he didn't come to be served, but to serve. And he actually used the language to be the servant of all. Well, what does all mean? Recently, there was these big, there was a guy in Arizona who lost his bakery business because he didn't want to make a cake for a gay couple, and they sued, and now he's losing his business because he's being, and I think all that's horrible. I think a societal fabric that says, you must serve what I want if it's the gay couple. I mean, you can't find somebody to make a cake, really? You want to take a guy out of business? That just seems that our nation's gone nuts there. And what is it? The mayor of some city now is requiring pastors to turn in their sermon notes on a specific issue that had to do with gay rights in a given community, as if she had the right to. I mean, our society's become, those who have been bullied have become the bullies of our society. And that's just true. And I have all the compassion in the world for people who have this sense of sexual orientation different from the norm, and it feels like they've been repressed and oppressed by society, and they have, and I get that. Is the answer to that that we turn around and become the bullies in society? That if we had a point of generosity, but where does generosity begin? I think it begins in the house of God. If you're the servant of all, what does all mean? Only serve those who believe what I believe and think how I think, and I'm not going to serve somebody who does it, lives it differently. I'm not, because I see it as a big battle to be won. What does it mean to be the servant of all? Because that's how the Son of Man came. That's how Jesus came. And he invited us into that same space. The greatest among you will be the servant of all. That it's how we serve in our culture, not how we shape it. So the second issue about, is it something that I'm going to get out there and, you know, I don't think God wants me to take my life, and if it gets extreme in the end, so I'm going to make sure you don't take yours. I'm not going there. I'm not going to live in that space. I don't think it's my job to make other people live true to the God I love if they don't love him. And if they don't see life his way, and I don't know what the ramifications are of that in the wider society. I know I grew up in that we got to defend morality, we've got to protect this, we've got to, and I just don't think it's endeared a world to God. In fact, our world's turning even more away from God, and even belief that God is in the things we say he's in. And I think we're losing that. So on the one hand, Greg, to me, I'm going to let God have that for me. I'm going to encourage that. God gets to decide when, how my life ends. And what I have is a great anticipation that his grace is going to be in that with me. Because I've seen it with other people. I've seen people get to death. And it's horrible. Death, when life ends, and sickness, pain. I mean, I've watched people endure the excruciating horrors of death. But they're not alone in it. God is with them in it, and redemptive things are happening. And I don't know but what that doesn't shape us well to the end. Does that give me the right then to make other people do that? I don't think it does. That's not where I'm landing. So I'm dealing with it two different ways. I do agree that it may not be something we're going to put on the rest of society, but society hasn't decided yet that's a good choice. Because I do think, on the air side, people would end their life too soon. Fear and panic would set in. And so I do think there's that, even before it's time. And so society hasn't even played that one fully out yet into some kind of thing. But anyway, this helps me too. I got this from something I was listening to on the radio the other day, and I heard this man. It's from a TED Talk. It's an EMT in New York City who decided one day, I mean, he always told people who he knew, he's at the accident, he knows they're going to die. And they would ask him, am I going to die? And he would, oh, no, we got this, because he didn't want them to have the fear and panic of dying and having to face that. And it was probably, looking back, it's probably more about his comfort than theirs, because he was in the middle of one accident, and he actually just couldn't lie to the person and told them, yeah, there's not much we can do here. And from that point on, well, let me have you hear it in his words.
From that moment forward, I decided it was not my place to comfort the dying with my lies. Having responded to many cases since then where patients were in their last moments and there was nothing I could do for them, in almost every case, they have all had the same reaction to the truth of inner peace and acceptance. In fact, there are three patterns I have observed in all these cases. The first pattern always kind of shocked me. Regardless of religious belief or cultural background, there's a need for forgiveness. Whether they call it sin, or they simply say they have a regret, their guilt is universal. I had once cared for an elderly gentleman who was having a massive heart attack. As I prepared myself and my equipment for his imminent cardiac arrest, I began to tell the patient of his intimate demise. He looked me in the eye and said, "I wish I had spent more time with my children and grandchildren instead of being selfish with my time." Faced with imminent death, all he wanted was forgiveness. The second pattern I observed is the need for remembrance. Whether it was to be remembered in my thoughts or their loved ones, they needed to feel that they would be living on. There's a need for immortality within the hearts and thoughts of their loved ones, myself, my crew, or anyone around. Countless times, I have had a patient look me in the eyes and say, "Will you remember me?" The final pattern I observed always touched me the deepest, to the soul. The dying need to know that their life had meaning. They need to know that they did not waste their life on meaningless tasks. I had responded to a call. There was a female in her late 50s, severely pinned within a vehicle. As the fire department worked to remove her from the car, I climbed in to begin to render care. As we talked, she had said to me, "There was so much more I wanted to do with my life." She had felt she had not left her mark on this earth. As we talked further, it would turn out that she was a mother of two adopted children who were both on their way to medical school. Because of her, two children had a chance they never would have had otherwise and would go on to save lives in the medical field as medical doctors. It would end up taking 45 minutes to free her from the vehicle. However, she perished prior to freeing her. I believed what you saw in the movies. You're in those last moments that is strictly terror, fear. I've come to realize, regardless of the circumstance, it's generally met with peace and acceptance.
Yeah, it kind of blows the whole novel movie thing out of whack that people who are facing the imminency of death have an acceptance and a peace that we wouldn't anticipate. Because if any of us heard today, you got cancer, you're going to die in the next 5 months, and that's a new diagnosis for us. I think most of us would sense there's a panic that would come in, and there's just a what would I be missing and how my life would change and maybe even despair over it. I think that might be true. But he's talking about in the imminency of it. Now, it's here. And notice the same reaction isn't there. That's what I've noticed with people on their deathbed. There's not the last throes of panic, and not that it can't be, but I've not observed it. And then he says these three things, which I find incredibly fascinating. The need for forgiveness. The awareness in the last moments of what I might not have done that I wish I'd had done. Or and needing somebody to acknowledge that. I think that's, boy, if the shame from the fall isn't there, isn't demonstrated there, I don't know what else it is that all of us feel at moments like that. And I think we've felt something similar, haven't we, at funerals of people that we really loved and cared about. It kind of brings you into a space of what's really important about life. Now, we forget it within a few weeks and get back to the frivolity of life. And, it's amazing how much time we do spend in frivolity. It's amazing how much the pleasure of the immediate robs us from the kinds of choices and things that allow us to enter into what has greater depth than love and life and meaning. And it's easy to serve ourselves and miss the bigger things in life. That's just true. It'd be great if these kinds of things would invite us back to that space. If I'm aware of what it may be like as I'm passing away, then I want to live my life now in light of that. I don't want to live with a sense of regret about the choices I've made and the way I live my life and who I love and engage. I don't want to live with regret. So if that means saying no to things that provide some immediate sense of gratification for a longer term finding my way into life and joy and freedom, even if it's painful, even if it means I say no to things I'd prefer to say yes to, that's worth doing. Second one, the need for remembrance. He said immortality, which is an interesting way to put that. Will you remember me? Will anybody remember? And isn't that what a lot of funerals stuff is about, trying to remember somebody? But it's not, and monuments, the way humans have done that for people who've got egos the size of the Pacific Ocean, I guess. Remembrance is just, you know what the remembrance that counts are the people you've loved. Kids, grandkids, spouse, friends, It's the way you love that people will remember you for. It's not what you've accomplished. It's always the way you've loved. The number one phone call out of the World Trade Center on the days when the people in the upper parts of the tower realizing there was no escape and they might die on that day was to call their loved ones and say, I love you. I want you to know how much I love you. That's you want to know where life is. Life is inside of love and the way, and that's what we get remembered for. And the need to know their life had meaning. Now, some of this gets twisted up, I think, in this real false thing for significance, and I need to be famous or need to make my mark in the world. And I think some of that gets twisted. But I love knowing that my life has meaning. If we could even, I know every night I go to bed, I have this, it's developed over the last 20 years, not really consciously, but this kind of the way I am now. As I lay down in bed at night and I prepare to sleep, which for me is a pretty quick deal. I get about 10 seconds here between laying down and sleeping. But I just muse on the day and my gratefulness at things I got to be a part of that day. And if we could even have a moment where we talk about what was meaningful today. And not from the guilt thing of, oh, I didn't do any. I watched the World Series game or I watched, you know, what I'm not into all that. God made us in a world. And part of that is that we enjoy this world with him. So I'm not a real stickler of everything's got to have meaning. But does my life have meaning in the context of how I live it? Is it meaningful? And how, the woman he gives the example of raised two kids, went to adopted kids into medical school, didn't really count because there was something else that she hoped was more important. And I think that gets weird. But I loved that little TED talk. I loved this guy being able to say, you know, I've decided not to comfort people with lies. I think that's a statement that's just fabulous to begin with. But then to see what happened is not what he expected to happen. And the greater freedom and life that came to people maybe had to clear some things. And maybe if we knew that going in, we would have a greater sense of letting God, which I think the only answer to that is letting God have this day. Make it as meaningful as you want to, God. And some of the things, I couldn't even begin to tell you, some of the most meaningful things I've ever done for people I did unintentionally. It wasn't like I'm trying to be meaningful. I don't think it needs to go there. It's just as you live your life loved and you follow those nudges that are on your heart and you say no to some things that are distractive to say yes to some things that are more valuable, that you get to live in bigger space and greater space. And then you see that it's not, let's go on a destiny binge of, you know, find my destiny and I'm going to be meaningful today. Because I think that leads us into twisted space. That's why I like at the end of a day to be, gosh, what am I grateful about today? And I don't have to think much. It's just, I'm grateful. I'm grateful for that conversation. I'm grateful that I took time with that person today. I'm grateful that I got that done. If it was, you know, the book I got that chapter done today or whatever. It's easy to skew that with our, and I think maybe part of the exercise is God would invite us into what is really significant in his way of viewing the world. Because the way we humans view it is pretty, pretty sick. And if we could see it the way he does and relax in the world and see, and this is not arguing against something we talked about a couple weeks about being playful. Because I think, again, the most significant moments of my life touching people have often been playful moments that caught people unawares because being the holy guy who writes books and does podcasts and travels, they had an expectation of me and an expectation of what that means that was distorted. And to find us in playful moments is shattering. I think we can't read the Gospels and not see Jesus in playful moments. The most playful, wonderful things I've heard in my heart have come from him. So I didn't say all this about death and dying. I guess the hope I want is, you know what? God's in it with us. When we were working on the shack and we were Max sorting out his stuff in the cabin in the shack, and you got all this stuff going on for Mac. You realize there's a lot of pain going on for other people in Mac's story. There's a whole lot of pain going on. And we thought about Missy, and one of the things we got talking about was, but wouldn't he be there too? And when you think about Missy being abducted, or you think about someone in some kind of trauma, arrested in a cell in Syria or whatever, we kind of don't imagine God there with them. We kind of imagine it without him. And so we added that line in the shack about, Mac, don't you think I was there too? I was with her. She was not alone. And I guess that's the hope I want people to have about death and dying, and even people you love. This couple I was with last night, whose daughter died. No matter what happens to you, and it can be tragic by world standards, we don't go through anything alone. That God is not with us, and that God's joy is to continue to work great triumph out of the tragedies of this world. And the greatest triumphs of all won't come in this age at all. They will come as we leave this world and embrace the age for which we were always created, and the life that God wanted us to live, that we know in part here, we get to taste it, we get to see moments of that glory. But then one day, when we transition from this age into the next, now we're going to see things we can only guess at now. And that will put the whole of our life into a context that may not make sense in the context of this world. But in the light of eternity, will make more sense than we could possibly conceive.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com or add your voice by calling our comment line at 805-539-6980.